side two. And we're going to have to review a little here.
The, although Bird was known to be a famous surgeon, the idea of his undertaking a new experimental thing was quite frightening to us. But Bernard said he had to have that done because he couldn't live the rest of his life as a cripple. And he did, and that operation, while it was very, very hard on him, because that summer, that fall, he went to teach at City College, you see, 25. Nevertheless, it did help. However, he would have bouts of pain and, I've forgotten the syndrome, which is a dumping syndrome, I think they call it, which goes with your inability to absorb food, and so there would be times when he would not be feeling too well. Mm-hmm. However, at the time when he took the encyclopedia job, he was really beginning to feel, we had already been in Seattle and he had had that period, and he was beginning to feel better.
And he was very happy having a baby?
Yeah, oh, he was delighted. He really wanted very much for us to have a family, but we never felt that we had enough money to have a large family, so he was very pleased, and he was also happy because of the fact that we lost the first one, you know, so he was very, he was a devoted father, a very intelligent father, too. He read all the Fox and the government pamphlets and everything else, and we had an excellent pediatrician who took care of our child, and whom we influenced a great deal, and he was a wonderful guy. I think your father probably knew him. The encyclopedia years were very good years for Bernard, and they were good years for me too, because I did a great deal of work and didn't have to depend on a job. I went back I worked on the daily worker. Yes, I was the labor editor, and I was supposed to write the labor articles, and I must say that I really was not that advanced in journalism to be able to handle a very stiff job of this sort, because I had to handle all the news that came in from all over the country, and even international news, which is a little bit too much for me. And the editor knew that. He saw
what
that.
Is the Gates? No.
No.
Clarence Hathaway was the editor of the Daily Worker at the time.
For that, it didn't matter.
Anyway, you had this part-time job where you covered the total. You were the only labor editor?
Not the only labor editor. And it became overwhelming, and I used to come home and say to Bernard, why do I undertake jobs that I can't do? There's so many things I can do. And I felt that I was being pressed into a situation for which I was not capable of handling.
When you write the articles, do they censor them, or?
Well, the editor always went over them, most of the time I would get news from, let's say, the Federated Press or some of the other news services, and all I needed to do was to edit them. But on the whole, it was tough, and I had to write a lot. And
a lot was going on then.
A very great deal was going on then, and I didn't feel equal to it. I really didn't feel equal to it.
Couldn't they put that
on? And on top of that, what?
Couldn't they?
Yeah. Well, they tried. I mean, they saw that it was difficult for me, and they were very kind about it, I must say. And I tried it out for about 8 or 9 months, and then I simply couldn't go on with it. And besides, they did need somebody at night, and I couldn't stay at night. Actually, it was a full-time job, not a part-time job. So, and especially now with the Trade Union Unity Council and doing a lot of things and all these organizing committees coming in and giving you...
Were the sharecroppers union
there were...
Not yet? Unemployed
not yet.
Council?
No, not yet. The Unemployed Council started around 31, and that was already... Yeah, that was... they were just in the beginning. And there was an editor, Herbert Benjamin, used to handle the unemployed councils and all the unemployed activities, so I didn't have to handle that. But generally, I would say that I didn't
teach you how to do it better?
No, there was no effort at all at that. They just left me alone.
Feel like anything else.
Right. They left me alone, and they gave me very little direction and guidance. They simply assumed that I knew that I had written a book on labor and lumber, therefore I was an authority on labor. And actually, I knew a great deal about labor. I knew the trade union movement fairly well because I had gone back and forth throughout the country, and we had discussed it in the Workers' Health Bureau all the problems that were developing in the labor movement. But I was not yet competent to handle a labor journalist job of this sort.
Right, and they didn't teach you how to be.
No, they didn't. They made no effort to help me, and that was something that was wrong too. But they claimed that they were busy, and they were. They had a very short staff. They didn't have competent people. None of the people were very competent on the staff. And that was no consolation to me, because I really wanted to be competent. But I felt that I had not had enough experience yet to be able to handle a job like that. And so the man who came in was a rather well-known, Bill Green's brother-in-law, and I've forgotten his name. And he took over from me, and of course he worked day and night. And he was a trained labor journalist who had worked for years before me. And naturally it was quite a different situation, and I was rather glad because I felt that that was too much for me. So by this time we had moved into an apartment in New York here, and the baby was thriving and everything was going along all right. And then I went to see Foster and said, I'd like to work in the trade union movement in some way, and he suggested I work with the Trade Union Unity Council. And there again I was in touch with all these organizing committees, writing leaflets and pamphlets. And
so you were a researcher and writer for
and
the
writer,
trade union?
Yeah, for the Trade Union Unity Council. Mm-hmm. And every so often they had to have a lecture on trade union organization, they'd send me out. You know, I was sort of, I did everything. There was, it
you
was
were a general labor education advocate.
Yeah, that's right. They did. I really couldn't define all the things I did. Sometimes I would be sitting down and writing a leaflet for a meeting. Sometimes I'd be writing a piece for one of the trade union.
Did you define your own job, or did someone suggest what you do?
Well, they would have a meeting, for example, and they'd say, well, let Charlotte do this, or let Charlotte do that, you see. And it would always have to do with writing something up or sending something to the newspaper, to the worker, or helping a trade union prepare an organization leaflet.
There was a lot of traveling, too?
No, it was mostly in the city. But it was a sort of an all-around job for servicing the various unions in the way that they had to be serviced, and there were very few people who could do this sort of thing. And I had a little skill in this regard, and I think I did fairly well. And then there arose the whole question of the rank-and-file committees in the American Federation of Labor. What to do with these, because they really needed organization. By this time, there were many, many rank-and-file committees all over the country. And Lewis
they were uncoordinated?
They were in touch with each other, but there wasn't any real organization.
They didn't have annual meetings?
Well, this was the beginning, you see. There was an annual, there were annual conferences after they got it organized. And Lewis Weinstock was put in charge of this. And he had set up already, when I came there, he had set up a committee of AFL trade unionists who were to oversee the activities of all these rank and file committees and keep in touch with them. And then he set up an editorial committee, and he started a paper called the Rank and File Federationist, and it was a much larger format, not a full size like a newspaper, but it was a sort of a half size, but it was very good. And the person who was the editor was a woman who became my lifelong friend.
Lucy something?
No, it was Margaret Greenfield, who later became a... Do you know her?
Well, no, I've read she wrote stuff on Gastonia.
Most recently, she has been a labor analyst. She's been an economic analyst for the public health school at the University of California in Berkeley. And she wrote many pieces on Medicaid, Medi-Cal. She knows the whole medical field very well. But that was before. She was an economic analyst. But she's a good writer, excellent writer. And she was the editor. But they didn't think she was political enough, you see. So they put me in there to work with her. And I was a little bit unhappy about that, because there again, he was an excellent person who was being displaced because they didn't think that she was political enough. And
they being the communists.
Well, Weinstock, who was represented, and the group. So I came in, and then Margaret and I worked together, Peggy.
Mean by political that she wasn't a communist?
No, I don't think so. I think it was that they just felt that she didn't have the a political understanding.
But that didn't mean the party that she wasn't. Was she in the party?
I never knew whether she was in the party or not. Mm-hmm. I don't believe so.
Uh-huh.
But she was a very close fellow traveler,
uh-huh.
I might say.
What were the differences that they felt she didn't have?
They never explained it.
Uh-huh.
As a matter of fact, it turned out, actually, that she didn't really want to stay because she had no money and she had to find work. And she perhaps had suggested that already to them so that they were aware of the fact that they had to get someone else.
And they were training
but it was,
you.
Yeah, and they were putting me in so that I could learn what was being done there. It may be that they used that as an excuse or a reason so that I wouldn't feel that I was displacing someone else. They knew that I had strong feelings about that, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the truth was that she got out, she just didn't have any money. She was absolutely broke. She hadn't had a job for a long time.
And was single.
And was living on just meager savings. And she had to find work.
And she was single.
And she was alone, yes.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and you and she got along very well.
Well, our relationship was always very good because I appreciated her. She was a very able, very competent person who, if she had had the means, would have made a tremendous contribution. And I was always sorry that she couldn't stay.
Uh-huh.
And of course, because I respected her and, so much, we grew to be very close friends, and we are to this day.
I really respected her very much because she had an angle on the economics of the society that I didn't have. I had the labor angle, but she
was
had...
Was she a Marxist?
No, I wouldn't think so, but she was very, very, very left, very left, and she agreed with everything that was being done, and she certainly wanted to see rank and file committees organized in the trade union movement because she knew how ineffectual the trade union movement was and how they weren't doing anything on social insurance and so on. So we worked together, and she had a very she was a good balance for me. I had the labor angle, she had the more general economic outlook, and we worked together until she decided that she wanted to she wasn't happy there, and she wasn't paying her very much, and she really needed the money, whereas I didn't, you see. So she got out, and we became friends. So we remained lifelong friends, and we're still friends. She lives in Berkeley, and I'm in touch with her all the time. We're very devoted friends. So I worked on the rank and file trade unionist, and it was in this organization that they started the bringing together of all rank and file committees, so that we worked in a coordinated way. There was an annual conference that was held, in which reports were made. And the work was stimulated, and there was definitely a resurgence of rank and file activity within the trade union movement.
And the AFL didn't feel threatened by this?
The AFL felt very threatened by it, and they carried on a tremendous campaign against the rank and file trade unionists. And in many cases, the active rank and file trade unionists were discriminated against on jobs and so on. There was a real struggle within the AFL. At the same time, we were pressuring for unemployment insurance and for old age pensions, Social Security. And this was the beginning, really, of the whole movement for Social Security. And it spread, and it was very successful. And we went on for quite some time. And then I worked with them, I think, until...
And it turned into the paper, the American Federationists?
That was the name of it. It was the Rank and File Federationists, we called it. The AFL Rank and File Federationists. And we got it out, I think, once every 2 weeks. It's a beautiful paper.
Uh-huh. And it's a big paper.
Yeah.
Well, it's Lucy Carner, did she write for it?
No,
the Rank and File Federationist, which is different from the American...
Oh, yes. Well, the American Federation was the official paper.
Right.
But this is called the AFL Rank and File Federationist. And of course, that's what they were angry about that. Mm-hmm. And then they began accusing us of building dual unions, or you see. But we were not. We were working within the Aethervel framework.
And were you working to get your own people elected in that?
Yes, yes. They were working for that. They were working for getting progressives elected in as rank and file representatives, and they would commit themselves to a program. And there was a great deal of activity, and there was a response from the workers, mm-hmm. who finally saw that this was something in their favor.
And your paper was mainly written for workers?
Mainly for workers.
And workers read it in a style,
right.
And made sure to use words
right.
that workers could
write. And we used to have rank and file correspondence. We had letters from the workers that we published, and good editorials.
And this was a full-time job for you?
And that was a full-time job. I didn't get much pay, but I didn't care. I mean, I was just interested in the job.
And your mother was taking care of...
And my mother was taking care of my daughter, and I was attending trade union meetings all the time, mostly of rank and filers.
Uh-huh.
See, they would meet in caucus, separate and apart from the union, and then they would decide on a policy, and then they'd go into their union meetings and they would fight for that policy.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a very, very good, it was a very disciplined kind of thing, and they had a very good effect within the union itself. And pretty soon they were getting jobs, and they were winning over some of the leaders. For example, in the printers' union, Elmer Brown, who was one of the outstanding leaders of the Local 6, one of the biggest unions, came over to our side. He became a member of the board of the Rank and File Federationist and the official organization, and helped to formulate policy. He was a very good friend of mine. I liked him very much.
He became a member of the AFL rank and file committee, the
is
board
Elmer
of the
Brown.
Yes, not the Federationist. The AFL rank and file committee was the group that supervised the activities of the whole of the national rank and file committees and also of the Federationists. So that he was not a member of the board of the Federationists, but he was a member of the board of the AFL rank and file committee. Yeah,
that's a correction.
Yes, correction.
Many of the people who had before been just good, honest trade unionists or trade union officials who found a home here because they were not at home in the bureaucracy of the AFL, you see. And so
were praying for leadership, or did they have any?
There wasn't
this training.
No. There was no. Overt Marxist training, but when a person indicated a certain amount of ability and he showed he was interested and he was progressive, well, we would suggest he's going to the workers' school.
The Brookwood school?
No, the workers' school,
the
communist school. We would try to get him to read The Worker, you see. And at this time also, I undertook to teach at the workers' school, and I taught at the workers' school for about 10 or 12 years.
What did you teach?
I taught labor history.
What? American labor history?
American labor history, yeah. We didn't have much European labor history.
Uh-huh.
And I was a member of the faculty of the workers' school. And then when the Jefferson School was organized...
It was mainly communists that taught there?
Only communists.
Only
party members.
And what? Who were the students?
Occasionally they would invite a non-party person to come in and lecture if he was very close to the party, you see. But most of the time was just party members. Who attended the school? Well, new recruits to the party attended labor history classes, and many of the trade unionists that we knew who...
It was a night school?
Mostly.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, mostly night. I used to teach from about... I had two classes, 6 to 8 and 8 to 10.
So you were pretty busy.
I was. Uh-huh. That's why Mira said I was a weekend mother. She often says that to me now, you know. We had some very interesting people. I remember, did you know Kenneth Fearing? He was a poet. He was in my class.
Wonderful poet.
Yeah, a wonderful poet. He was in my class. Later I encountered him in a job in which I was fired because they caught up with my jail sentence and so on. And he fought for me on the street. He was one of the public relations people, and he fought for me. He was very friendly to me. Oh, I had a lot of very interesting students.
Uh-huh.
and many of the intellectuals attended these courses, you see, because they wanted to know. They were very good. They were not too, at least mine was not too doctrinaire, you know. Uh-huh. I tried very hard to present labor history from the standpoint of the worker, and while I got most of my ideas, and I was mostly influenced by the Marxist interpretation of labor history, such as it was.
What books did you use?
Well, we used Bimba, Anthony Bimba. Uh-huh. Remember him? And he wasn't very good.
Right.
Yeah, he wasn't very good, but he was better than most. And then later, of course, I never used Foner. I just used my own sources. That's how I happened to write the Silvis book. You see, I was interested in that period, and I was interested in Silvis as the first president of a national labor union. So I wrote that William Silvis, which appeared in 1941. I wrote it in 1940.
And were you interested in women workers? No.
Yes, I was. I became a member of the National Woman's Commission of the party. I don't remember. It was the late 30s, I know.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, when Elizabeth Gurley Flynn came, and she was the head of the Women's Commission, I used to work
with. Was it a real organization or just...
No, it was a committee within the party,
uh-huh.
And it was under the supervision of the Central Committee. And it was a commission that mainly issued resolutions and programmatic statements.
Really organized women.
Programmatic statements about the situation in the world as it affects women. And every so often we would get a request, let's say from a woman organizer in one of the unions asking us to send a speaker. We did that, you see. So because we did speak about the importance of organizing women into trade unions, and we did bring up the question of equal pay and...
daycare?
No, that was still that was before. The earliest goal of the women's movement, as we saw it, was equal pay for equal work and organization of the women and no discrimination against women, you see.
And you were against the Women's Party and the ERA?
Well, when the Equal Rights Amendment was presented, we were against it because we felt that we had to work for protective legislation, and that would necessarily be in favor of one class of workers, and then we thought that by getting that, we would influence the legislation for the men. And so we worked very hard on a legislative protection. And I wrote many of the resolutions and many of the programmatic statements.
For the Women's Commission?
For the Women's Commission, yeah. And after Elizabeth left the commission and Browder's wife took over, I think she was there before, I don't remember. She was there before Elizabeth. Browder's wife was the head of the commission for a while, and she was zany. She was absolutely zany. She was a Russian woman that he had married, and she didn't really understand our situation at all, and she simply transposed or superimposed the Russian position on the American position, and we used to have all sorts of discussions with her about it. I thought she was the zaniest woman I ever She thought that I was, she didn't like me very much.
So you were really quite active in the Women's Commission.
Yeah, I was. All through the 30s, I was active in the Women's Commission and the trade unions and all these embryonic little committees that were being organized.
And you were never an out-and-out communist.
You
were never declared in any of the work.
No, and I was never involved in the cell work. I was always involved in official work of one sort or another. So I really never became a very active communist, except later when I finally became educational director of the hotel. And see, by 1938, the hotel workers and the food workers had reached a point where they were strong enough to become a union. And they established a union, and then it was a question of whether they should go into the CIO or whether they should join the existing AFL Hotel and Restaurant Employees Union, which was a very reactionary union and a very small union. And there was a big discussion, of course, which was finally decided in favor of Foster's position that we should join the mainstream of the American labor movement. And that's what they did, and they became an AFL local. And when I joined them, they had 30,000 workers already. It's a very big union. They did very well.
Now,
and the two leaders of that union, one was Sam Cranberg, and the other was Michael Obermeyer. were very dear friends of mine for a long time until things began to break.
Now you're, at least chronologically, you're working for the rank and file. And you continued to do that?
Yes, I continued with that until...
What did I do after that?
I think that went on until about 1935. And... Oh, yes, 1936.
Bernard's still working for the encyclopedia.
Yeah, well, Bernard's encyclopedia work ended in 35.
Uh-huh.
And after that, he was not well, and he had a terribly difficult time getting work. Columbia wouldn't employ him because he had joined, while on the encyclopedia, he had joined several of the student activities on the campus and spoken out. There was a threat of war, you know, and there was the beginning of Hitler fascism, uh-huh. And he had spoken out, and the Columbia administration didn't like it. And so he was teaching, he taught evening class.
A correction. Yes. An addition. There was rampant anti-Semitism in all of the universities at the time. And it was practically impossible for a Jew to get a decent job, no matter what his qualifications were. And Columbia particularly was not anxious to employ Jews, although it would have been logical for them to have employed him, since he was a PhD from Columbia and had worked very closely with the Columbia faculty while he was on the encyclopedia. The anti-Semitism and the combination of anti-Semitism and his outspoken anti-fascist views on the campus from time to time was such that they would not consider appointing him. All right. Go ahead.
Wow. And we were having a very hard struggle financially after he left the encyclopedia because he simply could not get any teaching work.
And your American Federation, your rank and file work was a paid job, but not paid a lot.
I don't know. They just paid my coffees and lunches, nothing else. It was not. I didn't really begin to get a regular salary until I became educational director in 1941 of the Hotel and Restaurant.
Uh-huh.
Employees Union, and
did that rank and file job end?
I think in 1935 they went on, but there were so many unions being organized at this time, so much activity outside of the rank and file federationists, that I don't recall what I did during that time, but I know that I had great difficulty getting work. And then I thought, well, maybe I'll go back to social work, you know, because we needed the funds. And the social workers wouldn't take me back because I didn't have a master's degree in social work. They had such stringent regulations by this time that it became a barrier not to have a master's degree. And I said to them I would not go back for a master's degree in social work. I didn't care enough about the...
And they wouldn't, maybe it was politics that they wouldn't accept you.
Well, I think it was largely the general situation. The economic situation was bad. And this was a way of keeping the jobs for those who had them, you see, because later they let down all the barriers. But at that time, it was difficult. In fact, I remember writing to Marion Hathaway, who had then become professor of sociology at the University of Pittsburgh. She had left Seattle after the big struggle that went on between the students and the university faculty. She was very disgusted. Finally, she got a job at the University of Pittsburgh. And she wrote and suggested some things for me to do, but I just couldn't get work. I couldn't find any work.
And what other things did you try?
I don't remember exactly, but I did try several kinds of things. I couldn't get on a newspaper because I didn't have a regular newspaper guild thing. You know, the newspaper guild was being organized then, and I didn't have regular credentials. If I had been working on the Daily Worker, I might have been able to get into the newspaper guild. But all these other activities, you know, the working on the rank and file federationists and the labor defender didn't qualify me for that.
Uh-huh.
There was one period when I was an editor of the Labor Defender, and I can't remember when that was, but I think that was before. That must have been between 31, 32 or something like that. So I was there for about 10 months as the editor of the Labor Defender. And then I think I went to the Trade Union Unity Council, and from the Trade Union Council to the Rank and File Federations. Now, in 1937, there was need for, there was a request from one of the organization groups for an organizer. And it came from the hairdressers in the Bronx.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked me whether I would be willing to undertake the job. And it was a very intelligent group. You know, the hairdressers in those days were frustrated actors or frustrated waiters or frustrated professionals of one sort or another, and they went into hairdressing in order to survive. And they were a very intelligent lot and a very interesting group of people. So they thought maybe I would do well with this. So they asked me would I do it, and I said I would. And I would organize. As an organizer, yeah.
Even though you...